Imagine waking up tomorrow morning, grabbing your phone, and checking the financial news, only to find out that the safest asset on the planet is just, it's suddenly worthless.
Right. Total panic.
Exactly. Like panic in the streets, markets frozen, ATMs are completely shut down. I mean, it sounds like a movie, but the entire global financial system rests on a foundation of instruments designed to, prevent exactly that from happening.
Yeah, it's the bedrock of everything.
It really is. So today, we are deep diving into the world of cash and cash equivalents. We're taking a huge stack of your Series 66 exam prep sources, textbooks, regulatory outlines, market history notes, and we're extracting the absolute most important pieces.
And breaking it down so it actually makes sense.
Right. But before we get into it, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 66 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend.
Yeah, definitely. So, jumping in, this is a massive topic.
It is. And frankly, it's one where people tend to lose like really easy points on the exam because they just underestimate it.
Because it sounds simple, right? Like, oh, it's cash.
Exactly. Cash equivalents are the starting point of the entire investment risk spectrum. I mean, every single client portfolio out there needs them, whether it is for liquidity, capital preservation, or just a temporary parking place between bigger investments.
Right.
But for the exam, they don't just want to know if you can, identify a checking account. They're going to test you on the subtle distinctions.
The traps.
Oh, heavily on the traps, specifically the insurance and risk differences. They want to know if you understand why these instruments behave the way they do in the real world.
Right, which means we can't just memorize flashcards. If you have ADHD like me, dry lectures just, they slide right off my brain.
Totally.
We need to deeply learn, retain, and be able to actually apply this stuff. So, to make sure this sticks, we are not going to just walk through a boring list of definitions. We're going to build a world.
I love this approach.
Yeah, so we have three recurring fictional friends who are going to act out all of our scenarios today. Let me introduce them. First, we have Cautious Carl.
Good call, Coral.
Right. Cautious Carl is a retail investor. He is terrified of losing a single penny. He probably keeps his mattress stuffed with gold coins, and he is absolutely obsessed with government guarantees. Like, if there is a 1% chance of loss, Carl is out.
He represents the retail side perfectly.
Yeah.
The individual depositor who prioritizes absolute safety above all else. Like, yield is a total afterthought for Carl. Return of principal is his only goal.
Definitely. Then, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we have institutional Iris.
He's a
Oh,
powerhouse.
yeah. Iris is a high-rolling corporate treasurer at this massive multinational company. She deals in hundreds of millions of dollars. She has major CEO energy, and she is always looking for like short-term parking spots for massive amounts of cash just to make payroll.
Right, and she represents the institutional side of the market. She operates on a scale where retail rules often just don't apply. Or, well, they apply very differently, and the exam loves to test that exact boundary.
For sure. And finally, we have Trader Tom.
Oh boy, Tom.
Trader Tom is a fast-talking, highly caffeinated interbank dealer on Wall Street who loves pawning things overnight just to make a fraction of a percent in interest.
Probably has like six computer monitors on his desk.
Oh, at least six. So you'll meet him a bit later when we get into the plumbing of the financial system. But first, let's start at the absolute safest end of the investment spectrum with Cautious Carl. Because to understand risk, we really have to start with zero risk.
Right.
The sources point us first to demand deposits and certificates of deposit.
The absolute safest of the safe.
Yeah.
But we need to understand the actual mechanism of that safety. It's not because the bank holding the money is some impenetrable fortress made of magic stone that can never fail.
Right. Banks fail all the time.
They fail quite frequently, historically speaking. The safety comes entirely from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC.
The famous FDIC.
Exactly. That insurance is what separates a bank deposit from all the money market instruments we will cover later.
Let me push back on that for a second, though. When you say insurance, people usually think of like car insurance or health insurance, where you have to file a claim, argue with an adjuster for 3 months, and eventually maybe get a check.
Yeah, totally.
Is that how the FDIC works? Like, if Carl's bank goes under, is he filling out paperwork for 6 months just to get his grocery money?
That is a brilliant distinction, and it gets right to the core of why the FDIC is so effective at preventing bank runs.
Okay.
No, Carl is not filling out paperwork. The mechanism of the FDIC is incredibly aggressive and seamless.
How so?
When a bank is failing, The FDIC usually steps in on a Friday afternoon, right after the bank closes for the weekend. The regulators literally walk into the buildings, lock the doors, and take over the systems.
Wait, really? Just lock the doors?
Yeah. Over the course of the weekend, they seamlessly transfer all the insured deposits to a healthy acquiring bank. By Monday morning, Carl's debit card works again, his checks clear, and his money is sitting in a new account at a new bank.
That is insane.
He doesn't lose a single penny of his insured funds, and he often doesn't even have to change his account number immediately.
Okay, that is fascinating. So the safety isn't just that the money is guaranteed. It's the speed and seamlessness of the rescue that actually prevents the panic.
Exactly.
So let's look at the most basic version of this protected money. Demand deposits. In normal human terms, we are just talking about a checking account, right? The concept is that the funds are available on demand.
Precisely. The bank must give you the money immediately upon your request.
Yeah.
You don't have to give them 30 days notice to go buy groceries.
Right. I picture a demand deposit as basically being like cautious Carl having cash in his pocket. He can pull it out and spend it instantly. But because it is so liquid, so instantly accessible, the bank can't really do much with it. They have to keep a lot of it handy in case Carl wants it. Therefore, it earns basically nothing while it sits there.
Yeah, almost zero.
The trade-off for total liquidity is zero, or near zero, yield. But Carl is thrilled because it is FDIC insured.
Up to the legal limit, which is currently $250,000.
Right.
And we will drill down very deeply into the math of that limit shortly. But first, we really need to contrast that highly liquid checking account with the other major insure deposit, certificates of deposit, or CDs.
Okay, yeah. The sources call this a time deposit. So how does a time deposit differ mechanically from a demand deposit?
A CD is a contract with a fixed maturity date and a fixed interest rate. When cautious Carl opens a CD, he is making a very specific deal with the bank.
Like a promise.
Exactly. He agrees to leave his funds with them for a specified period, let's say 1 year. By promising not to touch the money for a year, Carl is giving the bank stability.
Oh, so the bank can actually use it.
Right. The bank can now confidently take Carl's money and lend it out to someone else for like a 12-month car loan, knowing Carl isn't going to show up tomorrow demanding his cash.
Okay, I get that.
In exchange for providing that stability, the bank compensates Carl with a much higher interest rate than his checking account.
So it's like Carl lending his cash to a friend for a year, knowing he gets it back, plus a little extra for his trouble.
Exactly.
But let me throw a wrench into this.
Do it.
What if 3 months into this 1 year CD, cautious Carl suddenly has a midlife crisis and decides he absolutely must buy a jet ski today? Like he needs that cash right now. He marches into the bank and says, give me my money back early. What happens?
Well, the bank will give him his money. They're not going to hold his money hostage.
What to know?
But they're going to execute the penalty clause of the contract. They will slap him with an early withdrawal penalty. Mechanically, this usually means he forfeits some, or maybe even all, of the interest he had earned up to that point. In some very short-term CDs, the penalty could even eat slightly into his principal, though that's rare.
Wow.
The penalty is the enforcement mechanism of the time part of the time deposit. It's the disincentive to keep Carl from breaking his promise.
Okay, listener, pause and think about this. I'm going to ask you a direct question.
Listen closely.
If cautious Carl breaks his promise, locks his money up in a CD, demands it back early for his jet ski, and gets hit with this early withdrawal penalty, does he lose his FDIC insurance? Is a CD somehow less protected than a standard checking account because of this contractual penalty? Take a beat.
Think about it.
The answer is absolutely not. He does not lose his insurance.
Nope, not at all.
The penalty is strictly a contractual trade-off for a better interest rate. It is not a loss of federal backing. The principal amount he deposited is still completely backed by the FDIC up to the limit.
This is a fundamental concept for the Series 66. Mm-hmm. You have to understand the sliding scale of liquidity versus yield, right? Demand deposits offer maximum liquidity and minimum yield. CDs offer lower liquidity enforced by that penalty and higher yield. But their safety profile, meaning that FDIC backing against bank failure, is identical.
So the exam might try to trick me by saying CDs have higher default risk because they lock your money up?
Exactly. They will conflate liquidity risk with default risk. A CD has liquidity risk, meaning you might take a penalty to get it quickly, but it has virtually zero default risk if it is under the FDIC limit. The FDIC covers both demand and time deposits equally.
Okay, so cautious Carl is happy. His money is safe in his checking account, and it's safe in a CD. But let's bring institutional Iris into the picture.
Ah.
Iris is sitting in her corner office managing hundreds of millions of dollars for her corporation. She also wants the guaranteed return of a CD, but she operates on a completely different scale. This brings us to a major distinction in the sources, negotiable versus non-negotiable CDs.
This is heavily tested. To understand the difference, we have to look at the secondary market. Let's start with Cautious Carl's CD. His is a non-negotiable CD.
Right. Non-negotiable basically means non-transferable.
Exactly.
Right? Carl can walk into his local credit union with $500 and get one. But as we established with the jet ski example, if he wants out early, his only option is to go back to the exact bank that issued it, beg for his money, and take the penalty.
Right.
He cannot go on an app and sell his CD to his neighbor. It's a closed-loop contract strictly between Carl and his bank.
Correct. It has no secondary market. It is not a security that trades. Now, institutional Iris needs something very different.
What's her play?
Let's say she wants to park $5 million for 6 months to earn some interest. But she knows there's a small chance she might need that cash in 2 months if a massive supply chain issue pops up and she needs to buy raw materials quickly.
She can't risk a penalty on $5
million? No. She cannot afford to be locked into an early withdrawal penalty, and she doesn't want to deal with small local banks. So she buys a negotiable CD, which the market also refers to as a jumbo CD.
Jumbo is definitely the right word. From the sources, the minimum face value for a negotiable CD is $100,000. But in Iris's world of institutional finance, they usually trade in much larger blocks, often $1 million or more.
Much larger.
And they are issued by large money center commercial banks, not the little credit union down the street.
Yeah.
But here's the mechanism I want to unpack. The defining feature is right there in the name. It is negotiable. What does that actually mean for Iris if she needs her money in 2 months?
Negotiable means it can be freely traded on a secondary market to a third party.
Okay.
If Iris needs her money early, she doesn't go back to the issuing bank at all. She doesn't deal with early withdrawal penalties. She just picks up the phone, calls her institutional broker, and says, sell my $5 million CD.
Wow, just like that.
Just like that. The broker finds another institutional investor who wants to buy it. The new buyer pays Iris cash, takes over ownership in the CD, and that new buyer is the one who gets the final payout from the bank when the CD officially matures. This gives negotiable CDs incredibly high liquidity compared to Carl's non-negotiable CD.
Wait, hold on. If Iris sells her CD on the secondary market to someone else, does she always get her full $5 million back? Like, if she sells it early, who decides what the price is?
That is a great catch. No, she doesn't automatically get her exact principal back if she sells early.
Why not?
Because it trades on a secondary market. The price of her negotiable CD will fluctuate based on current interest rates.
Okay.
If Iris bought a CD paying 4%, and a month later interest rates across the economy rise to 5%, her 4% CD is suddenly less attractive to buyers.
Right, because they could just go buy a new one at 5%.
Exactly. So if she wants to sell it, she will have to sell it at a slight discount, meaning she might only get $4.9 million for it. She takes a small loss to get her liquidity.
That makes perfect sense.
Conversely, if interest rates fall, her CD becomes more valuable and she could actually sell it at a premium.
Okay, I see. So she avoids the bank's early withdrawal penalty, but she takes on interest rate risk in the secondary market. That is a huge distinction. Okay, listener, this is a prime spot for an exam trap. Put a mental sticky note right here.
The exam writers know human psychology. They know that when candidates hear the words traded, secondary market, and price fluctuations, they immediately think of stocks and they think of high risk.
So on the test, they will lay out a scenario with institutional Iris buying a negotiable CD. Then they will offer an answer choice that says something like, negotiable CDs carry higher default risk than non-negotiable CDs because they are subject to secondary market fluctuations and lack FDIC backing.
And if you are skimming, that sounds like a smart, sophisticated finance answer.
It really does, but it is completely false.
Completely.
The reality is that both non-negotiable and negotiable CDs are FDIC insured up to the $250,000 limit. The underlying instrument is still a bank deposit. The bank still owes the money. The only difference is transferability. The fact that Iris can trade her CD to Trader Tom does not magically erase the FDIC insurance on the deposit itself.
Precisely. Huh. Now, obviously, Iris is playing with $5 million, and the FDIC only covers $250,000. So $4.75 million of her CD is uninsured.
Right.
But the instrument itself is eligible for the insurance. If she bought a $200,000 negotiable CD, it would be fully insured, exactly like Carl's.
Never let the exam talk you out of the fact that a CD, whether it is Carl's tiny local one or Iris's massive traded one, is a bank deposit eligible for FDIC coverage.
You have to lock that in.
Okay, so since this FDIC insurance is the defining feature keeping cautious Carl from having a panic attack, we need to know exactly how this coverage works mechanically. We need to decode the FDIC rulebook because the exam is going to test exactly where the coverage stops.
Let's look at the famous $250,000 rule.
Yes, let's break this down.
The official regulatory rule is this. The FDIC insures up to $250,000 per depositor, per FDIC insured bank, per ownership category.
Per depositor, per bank, per ownership category. Every single comma and word in that sentence matters.
It really does.
Let's do some math on this, because the way average people talk about this in everyday life is usually completely wrong.
Always wrong.
Let's say cautious Carl walks into First National Bank. He opens a checking account and puts $200,000 in it.
Yeah.
Then, because he likes to keep things separate, he opens a savings account at the exact same bank and puts another $100,000 in it.
Yeah.
That's $300,000 total across two accounts. Does he get $500,000 in coverage because he has two accounts?
Absolutely not. The limit is not per account.
That's what people get wrong.
All the time. It is per depositor, per bank, per ownership category. A checking account and a savings account in Carl's own name are both in the exact same ownership category, individual.
Oh, okay.
Therefore, the FDIC regulators simply add all of his individual accounts at that one bank together. He has $300,000 total in the individual category. The FDIC covers the first $250,000.
And an arrest.
The remaining $50,000 is completely uninsured. If the bank fails, that $50,000 is gone, or at least tied up in bankruptcy court for years.
Wow. Okay, listener, test yourself right now with a slightly more complex scenario.
Here we go.
Carl has $200,000 in his individual checking account at First National Bank, but he also has $200,000 in a joint savings account with his husband at the exact same bank. So $400,000 total of Carl's money is sitting inside this one building. Is he fully covered if the bank is shut down by regulators on Friday afternoon? Take a beat and think about the rule.
Think about the categories.
The answer is yes, he is completely covered. Why? Because individual and joint are completely different ownership categories in the eyes of the FDIC.
Let's do the exact math on that to show how it works.
Please.
His $200,000 individual checking account is evaluated on its own. It is under the $250,000 individual limit, so it is 100% safe.
Right.
Then the regulators look at the joint account. The joint account is a separate category. And the rule for joint accounts is that they are insured up to $250,000 for each co-owner.
Oh,
yeah. Since Carl and his husband share it, that specific joint account actually have $500,000 in total coverage.
I see.
Since they only have $200 in it, the entire thing is protected. The exam will absolutely give you these multi-step math problems.
So the trick is to always group the accounts by ownership category first. Individual, joint, retirement, trust. Each category gets its own independent $250,000 bucket at that specific bank.
Exactly. Group them first, then apply the limit.
So wait, if Carl was super paranoid but really loved the tellers at First National Bank and wanted to keep all his money there, could he stack this?
Stack it how?
Like, could he have 250Ks in an individual account, 250K of his own share in a joint account with his husband, 250K in a self-directed IRA, and 250K in a revocable trust account, and basically have $1 million fully insured at one single bank?
Yes, he absolutely could.
That's wild.
Because the law treats individual, joint, retirement, and trust as four distinct legal ownership categories. He gets a separate $250,000 bucket for each. And if he somehow inherits another $1 million, he doesn't need to open more bizarre trusts. He can just walk across the street to Second National Bank and start the whole process over again.
Because the limit is per bank.
Exactly. He could have a fully insured individual account at 10 different banks.
That is wild, but it makes sense once you understand the mechanics of the categories. Okay, but here is where the exam loves to throw a curveball.
The biggest trap of them all.
We know what the FDIC covers. Checking, savings, CDs. But the exam loves to test what happens when retail investors buy non-deposits at a bank.
This is a classic behavioral finance trick, and it catches real people off guard every day.
Oh, so?
People trust bank buildings. They think the marble floors and the vault in the back mean that anything that happens inside those walls carries a government guarantee.
Right. Let's visualize this. Cautious Carl walks into the beautiful lobby of his local FDIC-insured bank. He goes up to the teller and says, I have $50,000, and checking accounts pay nothing right now. What should I do with it?
And the teller says, oh, let me introduce you to our wealth management desk.
Exactly. The teller walks him 10 feet over to a nice desk in the lobby, and the advisor there sells Carl a mutual fund or maybe a variable annuity or a whole life insurance policy. Carl signs the papers inside the bank building. The money comes out of his checking account. Is that $50,000 still FDIC insured?
Never. Not under any circumstances.
Never.
Never. The reality of the law is that FDIC insurance covers bank deposits only. It does not matter if Carl bought it inside the bank building from a bank employee who wears a bank name tag using a bank pen.
Right.
It never applies to stocks, bonds, mutual funds, annuities, or life insurance.
So if I'm taking the test and I see a scenario where a client purchased a mutual fund at a commercial bank and it asks about the insurance status, the answer is always, unequivocally, not FDIC insured.
Correct. The examiners use this to test your ability to separate the location of the transaction from the nature of the financial instrument.
Right. The location doesn't magically change the rules.
Exactly. A mutual fund is a security. It is regulated by the SEC. A CD is a deposit. It is regulated by banking authorities. Keep those two worlds strictly separated in your mind.
The FDIC protects you against the bank going bankrupt. It does not protect you against the stock market crashing and your mutual fund losing value.
Nailed it.
Pattern interrupt time. Shake it out, listener. Stretch your legs. We are now leaving the safety of the FDIC bank vault entirely. We are crossing the border into a completely different financial ecosystem, the money market.
This is a critical transition for your exam prep.
Huge.
The money market consists of short-term, high-quality debt instruments. It is where massive institutions go to borrow and lend cash for very short periods of time, anywhere from overnight to a few months.
Okay, but here is the most important rule. None of these upcoming instruments are bank deposits. That means zero FDIC insurance.
Zero.
If you see the letters FDIC next to any of these terms on the exam, you immediately eliminate that answer. It is wrong. Run the other way.
That will save you so much time on the test.
So if there's no government insurance, where does the safety come from? Why would anyone put millions of dollars into the money market?
The safety comes either from the pristine creditworthiness of whoever is issuing the debt, like a massive profitable corporation or the U.S. government, or it comes from collateral, which we will discuss when we get to repos.
So it's based on trust, not a guarantee.
Exactly. It is a market based on trust and credit, not government insurance.
Let's bring back institutional Iris to show how this actually works in practice. Iris is looking at her massive corporate dashboard, and she realizes she has a terrifying cash flow problem.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's Tuesday. She needs to make payroll for 10,000 factory employees this Friday. That is millions of dollars in cash that she needs immediately. But all of her company's cash is temporarily tied up in a massive warehouse full of new inventory that hasn't shipped to retailers yet.
A classic liquidity crunch.
Oh, right. She is a very wealthy company on paper. She's asset rich, but she is cash poor for the next 60 days until those retailers pay her. Hmm. What does she do? She doesn't go to a bank and apply for a 30-year mortgage.
No, that would take forever.
She issues commercial paper.
Commercial paper is the classic corporate money market instrument. By definition, it is an unsecured short-term promissory note issued by corporations.
Wait. Unsecured.
Yep. Unsecured.
You're telling me Iris needs $10 million by Friday, and she's just going to issue a piece of paper that says IOU with zero collateral backing it up. Why would anyone buy that? What if her company goes under next week?
That is exactly why commercial paper is only an option for the largest, most financially stable corporations in the world.
Oh, I see.
It is based entirely on the company's pristine credit rating. A startup cannot issue commercial paper. Only companies with massive balance sheets and excellent credit can do it. Investors buy it because they trust that a massive Fortune 500 company is not going to suddenly vanish in the next 60 days. Mm-hmm. The short duration of the loan significantly reduces the risk.
Okay, so she prints up an IOU that essentially says, I will pay the bearer $10 million in 60 days. But how does she get the cash today for Friday's payroll? She doesn't pay regular monthly interest on a 60-day loan, right?
Right. There are no coupon payments with commercial paper. It is sold at a discount to its face value.
At a discount. Okay, walk me through that.
This is a crucial mechanic to understand. Let's say Iris issues a $10 million piece of commercial paper. An institutional investor, maybe a mutual fund or a pension fund, looks at it and says, we will buy that from you today for $9.8 million.
Okay.
Iris gets $9.8 million in cash immediately, which she uses to make payroll. 60 days later, the paper matures and Iris's company is legally obligated to pay the investor the full $10 million face value.
Gotcha.
That $200,000 difference is the investor's interest return.
It's basically a massive institutional-scale payday loan, but for giant corporations. Now, here is the most testable fact about commercial paper in the entire series 66 syllabus.
Oh, the 270-day rule.
Yes. Listener, you absolutely must know this. Commercial paper matures in 1 to 270 days. It legally cannot have a maturity of 271 days or more.
Never.
Why 270 days? It seems like such an arbitrary random number. Why not an even 300 days? Why not a full 365-day year? This is exactly where the exam will try to get.
Oh, they love this trap.
I guarantee they will offer an answer choice that says something logical like, commercial paper is limited to 270 days because of investor preference for liquidity, or because the market demands shorter maturities for unsecured debt.
And if you see that answer, ignore it. It has absolutely nothing to do with what investors prefer or market demand.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. The real reason is entirely legal and regulatory, dating back to the Great Depression.
Right. The Securities Act of 1933. After the stock market crash of 1929, the government passed this massive law requiring companies to register all new securities with the SEC. It was designed to force transparency. But what does that have to do with Iris's 60-day IOU?
Well, registering a security with the SEC is a monumental undertaking. It involves filing an S-1 registration statement, hiring armies of lawyers and auditors, enduring months of regulatory review, and spending millions of dollars in compliance costs.
Ouch.
Yeah. So if Iris just needs cash to bridge a 60-day gap for payroll, she cannot possibly wait 6 months and spend millions of dollars for SEC approval. The economy would basically grind to a halt if companies had to register every short-term loan.
That makes sense.
So the lawmakers built a specific exemption into the 1933 Act. It states that short-term corporate debt with a maturity of 270 days, roughly 9 months or less, is exempt from full SEC registration.
Wow. So it's a legal loophole.
That's exactly what it is.
If Iris issues paper for 270 days, she can raise millions by Friday with minimal paperwork. If she issues it for 271 days, it suddenly becomes a fully regulated security, triggering massive SEC compliance costs that ruin the economics of the loan. So she always stops at 270.
Yeah, always.
Listener, burn that into your brain. The 270-day limit is strictly to avoid SEC registration under the Act of 1933.
Yes.
Okay, so Iris solved her problem using corporate debt, but what if the biggest entity of them all has a cash flow problem?
The government.
Right. What if the U.S. government needs to build a highway, but tax revenues don't come in until April? How do they borrow money for a few months?
Then we enter the realm of Uncle Sam's IOUs. We are talking about treasury bills, commonly known as T-bills.
T-bills. Okay. T-bills are the short-term obligations of the U.S. government. I know the treasury issues a lot of different things, notes, bonds, but bills are the short ones.
Right.
The sources point out the standard maturities, 4, 8, 13, 17, 26, or 52 weeks. They absolutely max out at 1 year.
And mechanically, they work exactly like the commercial paper we just discussed.
How so?
T-bills are sold at a discount. There is no interest check mailed to you every month. You buy a $1,000 T-bill at auction for, say, $980.
Okay.
The government takes your $980 today, paves the highway, and when the bill matures in a few months, they deposit exactly $1,000 into your account. The $20 difference is your return.
But the defining characteristic of a T-bill isn't the discount mechanism, right? It's the safety profile.
Exactly. T-bills are backed by the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the U.S. government. Because of that, they are considered virtually risk-free.
Virtually zero default risk.
Right. And because there is no default risk, T-bills serve a much larger purpose in the financial world than just funding the government. They are the anchor for reality in complex financial modeling.
Yes. The sources mention the capital asset pricing model, or CAPM, and the Sharpe ratio. I remember seeing these formulas and panicking because they have a variable for the risk-free rate.
Oh, everybody panics at CAPM.
What does that actually mean for the listener who has to calculate this on the exam?
Let's do an ELI-5, explain it like I'm 5 for CAPM and the Sharpe ratio.
Please.
Both of these models are ways of measuring how much extra return an investor should get for taking on extra risk.
Okay.
To measure extra risk, you need a starting line. You need a zero point. If you can earn 5% completely risk-free by sitting on your couch holding a U.S. T-bill, then why would you invest in a risky tech startup unless they offered you a significantly higher return?
Right. You'd need like 10% or 15% to make it worth it.
Exactly. That 5% T-bill yield is the risk-free rate. It is the baseline. Whenever an exam question asks you to calculate a risk premium, you always subtract the T-bill rate from the total return. T-bills are the zero mark of financial risk.
That makes so much sense. It's the baseline you compare everything else to. But here is the major exam gotcha regarding T-bills. It's the taxation.
Yes, and taxes.
The IRS always wants their cut, even if you are lending money to the government. You have to know how the IRS treats that $20 profit from your T-bill.
The tax rule for T-bills, and actually all U.S. Treasury securities, including notes and bonds, is that the interest you earn is subject to federal income tax. You cannot escape Uncle Sam at the federal level.
What?
However, they are entirely exempt from state and local income taxes.
Okay, let's put this into practice because the exam loves situational math-based questions.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you are an advisor and you have two clients.
Okay, setting the scene.
Client A lives in Austin, Texas. Texas has zero state income tax. Client B lives in New York City. Client B is paying top bracket federal taxes, top bracket New York state taxes, A&D, a special New York City local tax.
Client B is paying a lot of taxes.
Yes. So if both clients buy a corporate bond, they both pay federal tax, but client B is going to get absolutely crushed by state and local taxes on that corporate bond interest.
Exactly. But if you advise client B to buy a T-bill instead, they still pay the federal tax, but the state of New York and the city of New York are legally prohibited from taxing that treasury interest. It's shielded at the local level.
So on the exam, if you see a scenario featuring a client in a high tax bracket living in a high tax state like California or New York, and they are looking for a safe short-term parking spot for cash, T-bills are going to be a massive neon sign pointing to the right answer.
Yes. The tax equivalent yield for that New York resident makes a T-bill incredibly attractive.
Love that. Okay, so we've covered the corporate world with IRIS's commercial paper and the government world with T-bills. Now let's step into the shadows a bit.
Ooh, the shadows.
Let's go into the banking backroom. How do massive global banks interact with each other and with global businesses in the money market?
This is where we see some highly specialized instruments that essentially keep the global financial plumbing working.
Right.
The first one you need to know is the banker's acceptance, or BA.
A banker's acceptance sounds like a polite invitation to a country club, but it actually has a very specific, narrow, and highly tested use case. The sources define it as a short-term time draft, typically 1 to 6 months, that is guaranteed by a bank.
Right.
What is a draft and why do we need this?
The key application here is international trade. The exam will almost always tie a banker's acceptance to a story about importing or exporting goods across borders.
International trade. Got it.
Let's walk through the mechanics of why this instrument was invented.
Okay, picture this. Imagine a company in the United States wants to import a massive shipment of complex electronics from a manufacturer in Tokyo, Japan.
Okay.
The U.S. company emails the Japanese manufacturer and says, put the electronics on a cargo ship. It will take 30 days to cross the ocean. We will pay you $2 million in 90 days after we receive and inspect the goods.
From the perspective of the Japanese manufacturer, that is a terrifying proposal.
Totally.
They don't know this U.S. company. They don't have access to their private financial records. If they put $2 million worth of goods on a boat across the Pacific Ocean based on a simple IOU and the U.S. company defaults,
they're out $2 million.
The Japanese manufacturer is ruined. They have no legal recourse halfway across the world. The trust gap is simply too wide.
So the deal dies. How does global trade actually happen?
This is where the American bank steps in. The U.S. company goes to their major money center bank in New York and requests banker's acceptance.
Okay.
They essentially draft a document that says, pay $2 million to the Japanese manufacturer in 90 days. The bank reviews the U.S. company's credit, takes some collateral or a fee, and then stamps accepted on the draft.
What does that stamp actually mean legally?
By stamping it, the bank is legally substituting its own pristine credit rating for the unknown credit rating of the U.S. company. The bank is saying, if this U.S. company goes bankrupt tomorrow and doesn't pay you, we, the massive global bank, legally guarantee we will pay you the $2 million in 90 days.
So suddenly the Japanese manufacturer is thrilled. They aren't relying on the credit of a random American importer. They're relying on the ironclad credit of a globally recognized bank.
Exactly. The trust gap is bridged. The electronics go on the ship.
And here's a crazy detail. While that ship is sailing across the ocean, the Japanese manufacturer doesn't even have to wait the 90 days to get their money.
Right, because of the secondary market.
Because that banker's acceptance is guaranteed by a major bank, it becomes a highly liquid money market instrument. The Japanese manufacturer can sell that piece of paper on the open market today at a slight discount, get cash immediately, and whoever buys it collects the full $2 million from the bank on day 90.
Exactly. It facilitates the entire global supply chain. So for the Series 66 exam, if you see a question mentioning importing, exporting, international trade, or a time draft drawn on a bank, the answer is banker's acceptance.
Perfect. Import export equals BA. Next up in the banking back room are repurchase agreements, commonly called repos.
Repos are the absolute lifeblood of Wall Street's daily plumbing. To understand them, we need to bring in our third character, Trader Tom.
Yes, Trader Tom.
Tom is a fast-talking interbank dealer. He sits at a desk with six computer screens, shouting into a headset, executing massive trades all day long.
The technical definition of a repo is a collateralized short-term loan. One party sells securities to another party with a legally binding agreement to buy those exact same securities back at a slightly higher price on a specific date, very often the very next day.
Right. I need an analogy for this, though.
Me too.
A repo is literally an overnight pawn shop for billionaires and massive financial institutions.
An overnight pawn shop.
Yeah.
Let's run a scenario with Trader Tom. Let's say Tom has had a wild day of trading. It's 4:00 p.m., the market is closing, and he realizes he needs $10 million in cash immediately to settle some trades and satisfy regulatory requirements.
Blood.
But all of Tom's firm's money is currently tied up holding U.S. Treasury bonds. He is asset rich but cash poor. So he calls up institutional Iris, who he knows is sitting on a mountain of excess corporate cash.
And Tom says, "Iris, I need $10 million in cash overnight. I will sell you my $10 million treasury bond right now for cash. And I signed a contract promising to buy that exact same bond back from you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for $10,500.
So Iris looks at the deal. She
Right.
gives Tom the $10 million in cash today, and she takes possession of his treasury bond. That bond is her collateral.
Right.
If Tom vanishes into thin air overnight, or his firm goes bankrupt, Iris is fully protected. She just keeps the incredibly safe treasury bond and sells it herself to get her money back. The collateral removes almost all the risk.
And assuming Tom doesn't vanish, the next morning, Tom wires Iris $10,500. Iris wires the treasury bond back to Tom.
The $500 difference is the interest.
Yes, the $500 difference in price is the interest on the overnight loan. That implied interest rate is known as the repo rate.
It's a completely brilliant system. It allows institutions to lend each other massive amounts of money overnight with virtually zero fear because it is entirely collateralized by safe securities.
And the Federal Reserve actually uses repos constantly in their open market operations to inject cash into the banking system or pull cash out.
Which perfectly segues into the final backroom instrument, federal funds.
This is one of the most misunderstood concepts by the general public, and therefore it is heavily targeted by the exam writers.
Always.
Federal funds are overnight loans between banks of their excess reserves held at the Federal Reserve.
Okay, let's unpack the mechanics of excess reserves. By law, because of fractional reserve banking, banks are required to keep a certain percentage of their customer deposits as cash on reserve at the Federal Reserve. They can't lend out 100% of the money.
Exactly.
Let's say First National Bank has had a lot of people deposit money today, so they have $50 million in excess reserves sitting at the Fed doing nothing. But Second National Bank gave out a lot of mortgages today, and they realize at 4:30 p.m. that they are $10 million short of their legally required reserve amount.
Oh.
If they don't fix it by the end of the day, regulators will penalize them.
So, Second National Bank calls up First National Bank. They say, "Can we borrow $10 million of your excess reserves overnight so we can pass our regulatory check?"
And First National says yes.
They lend these federal funds to each other. It is an unsecured overnight loan between two banks. And the interest rate they charge each other for this overnight loan is called the federal funds rate.
Okay, listener, I want you to stop what you're doing and listen very closely. The exam trap here is massive.
Huge trap. They will ask you a question like, "Which of the following entities directly sets the federal funds rate?" And the options will be A, the President, B, Congress, C, the Federal Reserve, or D, supply and demand in the market.
Almost everyone taking the test for the first time immediately picks the Federal Reserve.
Of course they do.
Why? Because the word federal is right there in the name. It's the federal funds rate. And every time you watch the financial news, the anchor says, "The Fed raised interest rates today."
And they get the question wrong.
Ouch.
The reality of the mechanism is that the Federal Reserve, specifically the Federal Open Market Committee, or FOMC, only sets a target range for the federal funds rate.
A target range, not a fixed number.
Right. They issue a policy statement saying, "We would like the rate to be between 4.5% and 4.75%." But the Fed does not legally mandate the exact rate. They do not decree it.
So who decides?
The actual day-to-day, minute-to-minute rate is purely market-determined. It is negotiated between Trader Tom at First National and his buddy at Second National, based entirely on the supply and demand of reserves on that specific day.
Wait, if the Fed doesn't set it by law, how do they get the banks to actually listen to their target?
Through open market operations.
How does that work?
If the banks are charging each other 5% and the Fed wants the rate down to 4.5%, the Fed will jump into the repo market. They will buy billions of dollars of securities from the banks, flooding the banks with cash.
Oh.
Suddenly, every bank has excess reserves. Supply goes up, so the price to borrow the interest rate naturally falls down to the Fed's target of 4.5%. They nudge the market. They don't dictate it.
That is a phenomenal explanation. The Fed influences it by manipulating supply, but the rate itself is market determined. Remember that for the exam. Mm-hmm. The Fed funds rate is determined by the market. The Fed only sets the target.
Exactly.
All right, we have looked at all the individual puzzle pieces. We know our insured bank deposits from Cautious Carl. We know our uninsured, high-scale money market instruments from Iris and Tom.
Now for the grand finale.
Yes. Now, the Series 66 exam is going to throw two identical-sounding terms at you in an ultimate showdown. They want to see if you have actually internalized the FDIC rules we talked about an hour ago.
This is where candidates lose easy points, simply because they read the question too fast and their brain auto-completes the words.
Slow down and read carefully.
We have to explicitly compare money market funds versus money market deposit accounts.
I want you to put these in the ring together, side by side. Let's start with a money market deposit account.
The secret is in the last word, account. A money market deposit account is a traditional bank product. It sits at a bank. It is regulated by banking regulators, and most importantly, because it is a bank deposit, it is fully FDIC insured up to the $250,000 limits we calculated earlier.
Right. Cautious Carl loves his money market deposit account. It gives him a slightly better interest rate than his basic checking account, usually because it restricts him to only a few withdrawals per month, but it comes with the exact same ironclad FDIC guarantee.
Within those insurance limits, his principal literally cannot lose value. If he puts in $10,000, he will always have at least $10,000.
Now, in the other corner of the ring, we have the money market fund.
The key here is the word fund. A money market fund is a mutual fund. It is a security.
Not a deposit.
Exactly. It is regulated by the SEC under the Investment Company Act of 1940. It is a pool of money managed by an investment company that takes investor cash and goes out into the market to buy the exact money market instruments we just spent the last 20 minutes talking about.
Like Iris's commercial paper and Tom's repos.
Yes. Iris's commercial paper, T-bills, and Trader Tom's repos.
Because it is a security, not a deposit, what is the critical danger here?
Because it is a security, it is not FDIC insured. I cannot emphasize this enough.
Let me repeat that. Not FDIC insured.
Money market funds have zero FDIC protection, even if you buy them from a broker who has a desk inside the lobby of a bank building.
But they seem so safe. Like, the mutual fund companies design them to maintain a stable net asset value, or NAV, of exactly $1 per share.
That's the illusion.
So if I put in $1,000, I have 1,000 shares worth $1 each. It looks and feels exactly like a bank account. It doesn't fluctuate like a stock. But listener, think about the mechanics of what is actually happening inside that fund. What happens if the investments inside that money market fund tank?
Think about it.
What if institutional Iris's company goes bankrupt and defaults on all that commercial paper held inside the mutual fund's portfolio? Take a beat.
Right.
What happens to my $1 NAV?
It drops.
The fund can break the book.
Breaking the book is catastrophic. It means the net asset value falls below $1. Suddenly, your $1,000 investment might only be worth $970.
You actually lost principal on what you thought was a cash equivalent.
It is rare, but it is not hypothetical. It happened dramatically during the financial crisis in September 2008.
Oh, the Reserve Primary Fund.
Yes.
This is the perfect story to lock this concept in. The Reserve Primary Fund was a massive money market fund. People used it like a checking account. But the fund managers had bought hundreds of millions of dollars of commercial paper issued by Lehman Brothers, seeking a tiny bit of extra yield.
And when Lehman Brothers suddenly filed for bankruptcy, that commercial paper became worthless overnight.
So what happened to the fund?
The assets inside the fund dropped. The fund could no longer maintain the $1 NAV. It fell to 97 cents. Institutional investors panicked and tried to pull billions of dollars out of the fund at once, creating a run on the fund that threatened to freeze the entire global commercial paper market. The federal government had to step in with emergency liquidity facilities just to stop the bleeding.
That is the ultimate proof that a fund is not an account. The bottom line for your exam is this. If you see the word account, it is a bank deposit, it is insured, and your principal is guaranteed by the government up to the limit.
And if you see the word fund, it is an SEC-regulated security, there is no government guarantee, and you can theoretically lose money if the underlying commercial paper or repos default.
The word fund versus account changes absolutely everything. Read the exam questions so carefully. Do not just skim the words money market and assume you know what they're talking about.
Such a crucial tip.
Wow. We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We went from Carl's mattress to the Japanese shipping lanes to the Lehman Brothers collapse. Let's consolidate all of this. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways. Listener, lock these in.
Ready? Number one, demand deposits and CDs are bank deposits. They are FDIC insured up to $250,000.
Got it. Number two, negotiable CDs, also known as jumbo CDs. They are tradable on the secondary market. They start at $100, but they are still FDIC insured. Trading them does not destroy the insurance, but it does expose the seller to interest rate price risk if they sell early.
Number three, the FDIC limit of $250 applies per depositor, per bank, per ownership category. It is not per account. Individual, joint, trust, and retirement accounts are entirely separate categories that each get their own limit.
Number four, securities bought inside a bank like mutual funds or annuities are not FDIC insured. The location of the desk where you sign the paperwork doesn't matter. The legal nature of the instrument is all that matters.
Number five, commercial paper has a maximum maturity of 270 days, specifically to avoid SEC registration under the 1933 Act, saving corporations millions in compliance costs. It has nothing to do with investor preference.
Number six, T-bills are the safest money market instrument used as the benchmark for the risk-free rate in CAPM. They are subject to federal income tax, but they are completely exempt from state and local taxes, making them perfect for high-tax state residents in places like New York or California.
Number seven, the federal funds rate is market determined by banks lending their excess reserves to each other overnight. The Federal Reserve only sets the target range and uses open market operations to influence supply. They do not dictate the exact rate.
And finally, number eight, a money market deposit account is an insured bank product. A money market fund is an uninsured mutual fund security that can, in times of extreme crisis, break the buck.
Boom. That is the core of cash equivalents. You now understand not just the definitions, but the mechanics, the history, and the why behind the rules.
It's about the why.
But before we wrap up, let me leave you with a final provocative thought to chew on.
Oh, I love these.
We spent a lot of time talking about T-bills being the ultimate anchor of the financial system. We talked about how KPM uses them as the absolute zero point of risk because they are backed by the taxing power of the U.S. government.
Right.
But think about this. What happens to the entire global financial model if political gridlock in Washington ever causes the U.S. to actually default on a T-bill, even for just a few days?
Whoa.
If the baseline of zero risk suddenly carries a default premium, what happens to the math? Does the concept of a risk-free rate even exist anymore, or does every single asset on Earth suddenly have to be repriced?
That is a terrifying real-world question to ponder, especially as you look at those formulas. It really shows how fragile the assumptions underlying these exams can be.
It really does.
But for the test you are taking next week, trust the rules we laid out today. Assume the T-bill is risk-free. You are now officially armed, you understand the mechanics, and you are ready to absolutely crush the cash and cash equivalents section of the Series 66.
You've got this.